But before I forget, future thought, that on the final morning of our retreat together, an Israeli documentary TV company is coming here, and the primary reason for it actually is to make an interview with myself on spiritual emergencies. That's the theme of the documentary there. As if this country didn't have enough emergencies already. But anyway, one more at this point. And reason I mention it, they asked in the email, as they always do, would it be possible to film this bit in the hall? So I've emailed them, and I said, you certainly can't film before the final morning. That's not possible. It's too distracting. On the final morning, I will ask. I'll mention it now. And if someone doesn't want to be in it, because you might get viewed as a spiritual emergency. No, that one. No, that's not true. But then you just sit at the back, you know, for the closing talk. But they might want to film, you know, and as they do there. So this will be on the final morning, and usually we find the people less sensitive. And the good thing in this case, that the interviewer has done a retreat with myself, so she knows the sensitivities, and that tends to be very helpful. In the time of the retreat and the points that we're up to, the initial discourse, Satipatthana Sutta, Sati, mindfulness, Patthana, in the Hindi it means station. So you have, like, those of you who've been to Dharamsala, there's a station in the foothills called Pathankot. So Pathan means station. So in the Pali it means like application. So four important areas for the application of mindfulness. That's including the process of meditation. One is the body with the breath. The second are the feeling life. The third are the range of states of mind, and the fourth is the Dharma, which the Buddha includes sense doors. Need some assistance?
Translation.
Oh, very kind. Good. And Dharma includes senses and sense objects, so our relationship to the world in our contemporary language. And all four applications of mindfulness, of the power of attention, and working with, all four obviously matter a great deal in our life. Our relationship to the body, breathing, and if you have any doubts about the importance of the relationship to breathing, it's very simple. Put your head in a bucket of water. The interest will grow dramatically after a minute. That's the confirmation of interest in breathing. Sometimes people forget. And so breathing and relationship to body, how many issues we have around the body. Appearance, look, size, shape, age, colour, weight, etc. And health and sickness and form and energy. And all of those areas important for all of us in a whole variety of ways, and therefore the encouragement to learn to see body as body. And diet, of course, is a very important area as well. So when Leela and I are given the meditation instructions, when she and I are making some change in the instructions, a little bit day by day, it is important to remember here that it's not a hierarchical process. It's not a developmental model. Go from the more simple to the more subtle or more advanced. There's none of that. It's not going from samatha to vipassana either, as those of you know in the Ubakin tradition. Here we say every meditation, keeping in line with the Buddha's teachings, have the potential for us, all of them without exception and equally, to contribute to calmness and insight. All contribute to samatha and vipassana. Vipassana strictly meaning insight. There. So, in just in the process, not developmental, but just process of change, our experience and our exploration tells us what is valuable and works for us, and that's the important criteria there. So, to give a little flow with you here today. Initially, Lili and I are giving instructions to use the one of the buzzwords last night, some guidance, there I use the word, and in giving some instructions or guidance, initially with the breath. And there is the encouragement with the breath, different aspects to this. One, of course, the bridge of mind and body, to harmonize mind and body, to really sense the well-being of mind and body, and just the quiet attention and sustaining it with the experience of breathing in and breathing out, and without the act of the will, as we connect more easily with the breath, generally it gets a little easier there. What is helpful is the sense of diversity or differences. In other words, no two consecutive breaths can be the same. Nothing, in fact, can repeat itself if we're really clear. No event is the same as yesterday's. It's constantly changing, adapting, modifying, undergoing differences again. So when you and I take a breath, the image may be, oh, one breath is much the same as another. And this is just a picture. This is just the memory and the interpretation. But if we're really mindful, really engaged in the application of mindfulness, satipatthana, it's like the station, something that you get on, you get on the train, and you get off the train at the next station. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes our station that we arrive on is the breath. Sometimes the station that we arrive on is the body. Sometimes it's the feelings. Sometimes it's states of mind, anguish to deep jhanas and deep absorptions, etc. Sometimes the station we are on is the event between ourselves and the world around. So, in the first application of the mindfulness of the breathing as the primary object, and because it's connected with calm and insight, two important aspects of our practice, equally important aspects there, sometimes with the calm element, it really is a genuine interest in relaxation. Upright posture, mindfully breathing in, plenty of relaxation on the exhalation, which is when our mind most easily wanders. Or those moments before the next in-breath comes in, we breathe in, we breathe out, we breathe in, we breathe out. And noticing as many differences. So when you breathe in, the feelings, sensations that arise in the lungs expanding in other parts of the body, a lot is going on with a single in-breath, and what's going on within with this in-breath is not the same, exactly the same as was with the previous one. Similarly with the outgoing breath, there is a lot going on when we breathe out, and in the breathing out the body is also undergoing some sensation. sometimes in the sitting, you may notice, that the physical posture unintentionally has changed. And this way, I'm sitting here, and then suddenly I'm leaning. The back has dropped down, it feels, starts to feel perhaps a bit heavy in the back, or whatever. Do allow yourself to rest in that posture. Feel that sensation. Feel that experience of there has been a change. If you do, say, it's better to change the posture. Yes, I might be sitting here and quite regularly, and slowly move up, straighten the back up. If one does it mindfully and consciously and not a reaction, it genuinely seems like the application of mindfulness in the practice has continued. It's not just about sitting still absolutely with strong resolutions. Sometimes people get themselves into a lot of pressure and a lot of tension by using willpower. I am not going to move. And that can contribute to people having to make documentaries. Do you see what I mean? So we're interested in the we're interested in the application of mindfulness, and what plenty of us have found over the years that when we're not in this rigidity of view about sitting still and not moving, not having this rigidity of view, we can make some appropriate, skillful, necessary change in the posture, and that could also be stretching the leg out if one has some knee troubles, or moving the back, or whatever it might be. And it is not an interruption. It doesn't feel like, oh, I've just lost the posture, I couldn't handle it, I've broken the meditation, I'm no longer concentrated, or whatever. Buddha's teachings, it uses the word, the applications of mindfulness, to the extent necessary, to what feels right and works for you. And so, in the flow of the day, in the sitting posture, it's useful and valuable to give care and attention and to see where you are with the beginning, middle and end of the period, because each aspect, that means beginning, middle and end, is important to us. And it might be sometimes, I see for myself and you can see too, that our relationship to the beginning, middle and end of a meditation may be a mirror image of the beginning, middle and end of other events in our life. We can find out a lot about ourselves through our relationship to the form. For example, some people are very, very slow to start. Got an idea, wish to initiate, innovate, start something, but etc. And sometimes that may show itself in always waiting for the absolute last possible minute to come to the meditation hall. You know, one would think one was going to the dentist to have all one's teeth out. Some people would prefer that, I think. And then some people, it's in the sitting itself. Person comes in, right, and sits down cross-legged or chair or whatever, but spends half an hour looking for the perfect posture, only to realize after half an hour there isn't one. And so that's half an hour looking, Maybe I should sit this. Perhaps I should sit full lotus, half lotus. Maybe today I should be on the chair. Perhaps I should use the kneeling posture. Maybe I should have three cushions. No, four cushions, plus a couple more here. Maybe, maybe, maybe. And then you hear, oh, it's all over. Never quite got going. You know, in these situations, those who laugh loudest. Touch the spot. Then there are others who are the middlers. I call them the middlers. And they're in the middle. Not the middle way, I have to say. Just middlers. And the middlers, you know, they're a bit slow to start, but eventually they get into it. All right, now I'm settled into it. But then the last, first third of is a complete waste of time because they can't make up their mind which posture. And then the last third, they're just waiting for it to be over. See, it's a 45-minute sitting, last 15 minutes, oh, come on, Christopher, come on, Leela, ring the damn bell, you know, liberate me, please, etc. So, and some people don't even believe in God, but they start praying. They never knew they had a prayer in them, you know, they're just waiting for the sitting to be over, start praying, come on, come on. Oh, there. So, and that may reflect and mirror itself in lots of other situations in life. Very slow to start, you know, getting with the middle period, might be in contact with it, or might not even realize there's one, and then waiting for it to finish, waiting to be over, waiting for the end of the day. And sometimes people who are working, you know, 5 days a week are like that. They start on the Sunday morning, oh God, another week of work, etc. Just waiting for the Friday to come, the weekend off. And just waiting, and the whole life is spent hating Monday morning and waiting for Thursday night, or whatever, Sunday morning, waiting for Thursday night. And this thing, so we want to be able to look and say, how am I? Part of knowing ourselves, it's insight, it's vipassana. What's my relationship to beginnings? What's my relationship to middle periods of situations? What's my relationship to endings? About anything in life. Because our life is involved in beginning, middle and endings. That's a bunch of our life. It not only arises, of course, in the meditation hall. It's also outside as well. We have the standing period. Time for reclining posture here and outside, the walking meditations there. And sometimes with any of those postures, we will, even though for some find it more comfortable and easier, we'll do everything possible to avoid walking up and down. You know, go to the bathroom and 25 minutes to brush the teeth, you know, whatever. Read every notice on the notice board 3 times, you know, whatever. You know, go and read those lovely sweet messages on the refrigerator, you know, whatever. Anything but walk. Anything but be with oneself. There. So, want to look as the days go by. How is our relationship to the walking meditations there? And sometimes the view affects this as well. That one's got all these dreadful archetype images of the Buddha, nearly always cross-legged. You see, that's the unfortunate thing. Not always in the monasteries, you have the standing walking postures, but generally speaking. So there could be a hierarchy in the mind as well. And some teachers, teachings have a hierarchy. Sitting what it's all about and the rest is just distraction. No, it's not. Life is walking, it is standing, it is reclining. If everyone's got a hierarchy, then the view can be, well, the real action, or non-action, takes place in here. And then outside, we just fill in the time, you know, wander around, space out, and wait for the beloved bell ringer to bring us back in here, etc. But life is indoors and outdoors. It is the four postures. each posture is equally worthy of respect. And in a way, from the time we stand up at the end of our sitting period, can we remind ourselves, the standing period has just begun. Right from the time we're in here, the walking period has just begun. That can be as subtle and as deep and contribute to calm and insight as much as the cushion. And if we get that sense, the application of mindfulness will begin to resonate through the day for us, and the insight aspect, beginning, middle and endings, comings and goings, subtlety of change and transition, learning to be with that in a non-grasping way, will contribute to the insights and the understanding, to really make that a priority. We then, from the breath, Leela spoke to you yesterday morning, and this important area of working with the body, and especially the pains in the body. For most, not everybody, not even everybody in the hall here, but for most of us, we are in the privilege of experiencing pain, knowing at any point in time we can just change the posture, boom, it's gone. It just, pain in the knee, stretch the leg, just disappeared and so nothing was there. Some don't always have that blessing and that privilege, and pain can be arising quite consistently there. And part of our practice is not fleeing from life, but actually, it's not easy, actually getting closer to it. It's not a detachment from life, it's not in the teaching. The word doesn't even appear in the Buddhist discourses. But it's an intimacy with life. Very, very clear intimacy. And quite often, if there is a detachment from life, detachment from the body, in that gap, that detachment, it's then when all the projections come. They come out of detachment, come out of disconnection. So when we're disconnected with the body, we'll have all these views about ourselves. I'm young, I'm old, I'm thin, I'm fat, I'm tall, I'm short, I'm ugly, I'm beautiful, I don't like this part of the body, I like this part of the body. This body, I wish I wasn't born like this, I wish this was better and changed, or whatever. All this is alienation. It's not actually being in touch with the body, it's all the projections that we've inherited. And of course we have all this huge industry to promote this. And sometimes you go into the magazine shop, and just on women's magazines for a moment, only men's magazines, you'll see someone on the cover. Wow, so beautiful, so beautiful. But then one has a little knowledge, because one's talked to photographers. Well, they look so unbelievably beautiful. They've got this expensive hairstylist for a start, with all the colours that can be added. They've got the cosmetics doing all that up. And then they've got all the perfect lighting. And then they've got the software. What's it called? Photoshop. Take out all the little blemishes. So by the time you've got all this beautiful cosmetics, the most fantastic clothing, hair in perfect place, with beautiful cameras, soft lighting, and Photoshop together. I mean, even Christopher could look beautiful. Well, perhaps not, but anyway, you know what I mean. There. So we inherit these images from these magazines there, and men too are assaulted with it, about themselves and about women, etc. Is it any wonder? I travel in this world, Christ, shut up. I've never in my life seen a single woman or man who ever compares with these people on the cover of these magazines? I'm always asking myself, where are they living? Because I don't see them. Wherever I go, I don't see them. So there's a whole myth around beauty or whatever. For us, to see body as body is to really in touch with body as elements, the body as organic life, the body as a field of vibrations and sensations, to really be close to the body, to really feel it through, to really see its nature. And sometimes in connecting with that and getting really well established with that, of course, as Lily was saying yesterday, pain arises there. And it's our practice and exploration not to be afraid of pain, not trying to control it, not to get it under our willpower, but just to explore it. What is this human experience of pain all about? Can I feel my way into it in a relaxed way? Notice the variety of sensations that arises there. See, can I be with it without resistance? That's the key. When I resist, I'm fighting. When I'm fighting, I'm creating tension. When I'm creating more tension, I'm creating more pain. So can I learn just to relax and to be with? It may be in relaxing and being with, without any filters or images that arise, that the pain stands out more, because once we're not employing all the defense systems. So the pain is bare consciousness and bare pain. Think, whoa, because I haven't got all these filters going on. Oh, I don't want this, I can, etc. But in that, though it is hard and challenging for us, but there's something honest and clear about it, and we can learn to expand the pain horizon. We can place our attention into the locality, feel it through, keep the attention moving, apply the mindfulness to it, see that. And of course there's lots of very good tension, stress reduction programs taking place, and the initial motivation behind that of John Kabat-Zinn and many others was helping patients, in this case, who are pre-operation and post-operation, and patients who are taking lots of medication and still feeling pain there, were given these practices. I remember when John Kabat-Zinn started, I remember giving, I may say, lots of encouragement in the basement of the hospital where he worked as a scientist, and people's lives were being transformed by these very practices that you and I are doing here, because the tools were being given for people to be able to work with their pain. And of course it's now become an extremely widespread movement, and it's a great credit to John and to Brian Tucker, who was his first secretary, a very dear friend of mine, and many others who initiated this whole project. And so as we sit, yet we must remember as well that with that, to have the freedom, it's the great freedom of life, it's a privileged one, that if necessary, we can move. I've never in my life given strong determination sittings to people. Never said you should sit and not move. I'm not. We're interested in wisdom and clarity and calm and insight. And the more we can relax with the body, and Lila and I are both commenting how quiet and still it is very, very quickly in the hall here already. The more relaxed feeling, the more we do settle with the body, and the more steady we are able to be. There's the breath, and then there's the body, and then there's the total relationship to the event. And again, it's part of the practice to, shall we say, lower the temperature of I and my around the body. I am sitting here, or my body, and the practice then, the mindfulness, the application of mindfulness brings in, Dharma language is called a non-self perception. And the non-self perception, no rejection, no detachment, certainly no cutting off there, but to see, to use the Buddha's words, body as body. That's all. To see, as I said, body as elements, or body as stillness, or body as movement, or body as organic life, or as body as breathing, or as body as a field of sensations. All of those words which I just used is to see body as body without the grip and the grasping of the I and the my. That's all. It's with not self as some kind of belief system, but sometimes just in our own practice, and sometimes in our own language as well, we are saying, the body is experiencing these sensations. Sometimes quite naturally, the I and my drops out of the words. Sometimes the knee, rather than my knee, the knee. And that language and experience with the language sometimes of experience in the body as feelings, sensations, organic life is loosening the grip of I and my. With that, one of the important aspects, it gives us a much clearer and more wise relationship with body. One understands or begins to understand that many, many factors affect the body from the past, hereditary and DNA must be included. It's extremely hard, and the scientists will not be able ever to work it out, because nor we, what, as it were, percentage is coming from the past, hereditary and genetic, what percentage is environmental impact upon us and the world, it does have an impact, and what percentage is coming from my own relationship to the body. But I just had a lovely email yesterday from one of the retreatants who was on the previous retreat, and we'd had some inquiry about the placebo effect. Anybody understand the word placebo? Mm-hmm. And she was saying from some of the contemporary research how, when people have the placebo, take the placebo, they don't know it, and the doctor, she or he, really listens and gives care to the client, to the patient, and the placebo is offered. The combination of that begins to allow the person to feel relaxed, loved, understood, there, and as the whole heart and mind relax and feels heard and feels well, and I have some medication to take, there, that takes the pressure off the body, and the body has more chance for some healing, and the pain seems to go down. This is that. So meditation is the placebo effect. Basically, it's no little pill, you see, in that respect, but it's a employing simple little things. I mean, mindfulness, you know, and observation of the breath and some attention to sitting and walking, you know, it's the placebo, isn't it? But nevertheless, the benefits are deep. And sometimes, of course, and it's quite necessary there, so there is no romanticizing in that respect. Sometimes medication is vitally important. People must take the responsibility with that, and hopefully it's a temporary measure. Not in all cases, but hopefully it's a temporary there. So, we've been working with the breathing. We've been giving attention to the painful areas of the body. Second. Thirdly, we're feeling some settled and calmness, just to look at the whole body as belonging to nature, an expression of nature, returning to nature, seeing it in that way, very closely, seeing it in that way. This helps to reduce the I and the my around the bodily life. Sometimes, just finally, we'll speak to you more as the days go by, sometimes we don't even have to give attention to the body. Sometimes there's just a sense of clear, calm presence. And just to be in a state, any of the postures, just clear, calm presence. Just presence. If the mind wanders and drifts away, if we're not making the application of the mindfulness to the breath or to the body, and the mind just then starts to wander and drift, we would suggest just coming back to the breath, coming back to the body, make that the station to get to be with, stay steady with it, when you feel clear, and just open up and expand the attention. You might have a sense of the space around the body, so that the body has a feeling of the sense of belonging, connected with something greater than itself. Sometimes you just expand out, but sometimes that expanding out, one expands out, but then space is out, and then if it's spaced out, okay, back. Use the sitting, walking, standing, breath and body as a valuable reference. Okay, enough. So let's have a little sitting together.